Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Fort Worth in Texas. Today, I welcome to the show the author of a fascinating study of the goddess in world tradition. And you know, we had a show on this subject a few months ago with the author, but unfortunately, Mother Nature got involved and there was a tornado warning and everybody had to go down into the basement. So we had to abort the show. So if you were one of those that was listening back then, here we are again. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the show, and hopefully we get a full show this time, Isabella Price. And her book is entitled Goddess Power, Awakening the Wisdom of the Divine Feminine in Your Life. And the author, Isabella, like I said, offers the book as one in her series on One Truth, Many Paths, that examine the ethical, mystical, and symbolic systems and approaches present in every religious tradition. That sounds like a fascinating study. Isabella is a teacher at JFK University, at the Californian College of the Arts and other venues, and she's traveled extensively to religious sites and participated in numerous rituals and paths. And so she's put together a very fascinating book that covers the subject of the divine feminine from the earliest times, from Paleolithic times up through various ancient religious traditions to current traditions like Hinduism and now the resurgence of our interest in the goddess and the feminine in the West, in terms of Mary Magdalene and Holy Mother and the Madonna and that sort of thing, which has become very, very popular lately. So it's a great joy to welcome Isabella back to the show. Glad you're with us today.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here with you and looking forward to our conversation. And let's cross our fingers that Mother Nature will allow us to complete it today.
So that's right, absolutely. I don't think there's any tornadoes in the air right now, so we should be okay.
Good to know.
I know you're interested in integral theory, right? And the idea of transpersonal psychology, you know, that every part of what happens to us is valuable. And, you know, in the old days, we kind of separated things, you know, especially in the Western tradition. You had all the bad stuff was attributed to the devil, and all the good stuff to the angels and to God, and it created a sort of a dualism. You don't see that dualism in ancient traditions, and you certainly don't see it in Hinduism, you know, which embraces the shadow side, right, instead of demonizing it. And unfortunately, the feminine has been kind of demonized in some ways, you know, in our patriarchal tradition. Mm-hmm. That is changing, though, right?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for bringing this up, and it's a good start. I do feel that she is reemerging in our times, what I also call the feminine face of the divine, because, you know, there is both, you know, masculine and the feminine face, and I'm at actually adopting a term that the mystics have been using in all the faith traditions. And we also need to be clear that, you know, what we call you know, this patriarchal conditioning in all religious systems, you know, across the world cultures is primarily in, you know, the more traditional understanding of religion or traditional consciousness, and more in institutionalized, organized forms of religion. Again, the mystics who have always dived deeply into the spiritual core of each faith tradition have actually always talked about the feminine face of the divine as well. And of course, then we have traditions like Hinduism today where, you know, the goddess is highly celebrated and venerated and has been kept alive thousands of years in the so-called Shakta tradition, the tantric branch of Hinduism, especially in southern India and in the eastern part of India, in Bengal and Calcutta. The goddess has always been and still is very alive. You travel to India, you see her effigy on buses, in restaurants. She's just omnipresent. And I want to perhaps just wrap this up by mentioning one more example that most people are not aware of, which always, you know, is surprising to me, that during the lifetime of Jesus Christ, as you know, his language was Aramaic, and the word for God was actually a parent, God as a parent in Aramaic. Abun Bashmaya means God as both father and mother as well. And that's something you hardly never hear. And again, most people, especially in mainstream Christianity, seem to be completely unaware of that. But so the later on, of course, God as mother, got lost in translation of scripture, and especially when, you know, the institutions became increasingly patriarchal because they were exclusively managed by men, especially then in the second, third, and fourth century after the crucifixion, was the church, you know, emerging as a, you know, consolidated entity. So I just wanted to give you, you know, some examples, and you know, then that hopefully will allow us to dive deeper into the subject.
Right, and of course, you know, as Christianity developed, you know, it demonized the old religion, didn't it? The pagan religions, yep, of the countryside, and made those religions the work of the devil, almost. You know, and the people who maintained those traditions were often women, of course, because they held the ancient traditions together, and then they would devolved into witches and whatnot, and so we have this ancient tradition that is very potent and very beautiful, but has been excised because it didn't fit in with, like you said, the patriarchal way of looking at things. Coming back to Jesus, though, especially if you read the Gospel of Luke, but this is true in other Gospels too. You know, Jesus surrounded himself with women, didn't he, throughout his ministry? And in fact, the people who saw him first, you know, when he rose, were women, right? They were incredibly important. And since we know that the Gospels have been tinkered with, well, they were written by men, and they've been redacted and changed over the years. We know that there was probably more emphasis on the female, and so the fact that they've survived so much, you know, so much evidence, is proof positive that Jesus was very open to the feminine side of things, you know.
Yes,
and lifted up women, right?
Right, absolutely. Yes, indeed. It's so true. And we know that he surrounded himself not only with male apostles, as the church later on, you know, as you know, created the whole doctrine of the apostolic succession and why only males should be priests, but Jesus was really, as you know, theologians say, the last friend of the female gender in the church tradition, surrounded himself with female apostles. And in fact, Mary Magdalene was the first of the most important one, the Apostle to the Apostles, as she's called. And as you mentioned earlier, she was indeed the first one to witness the resurrection. As we read, not only in the Gnostic Gospels, but also in the canonical Gospels, but the Gnostic Gospels, you know, the Nag Hammadi library, as they are known, really tell us that she was the one who got a deeper understanding of the spiritual meaning of Jesus' teachings. In fact, she was the one who got initiated into the core teachings by Jesus himself. And so her position of leadership, you know, within, you know, the women surrounding Jesus is earned and validated by Jesus himself, but only in those Gnostic or non-canonical Gospels. And of course, the women had to meet in secrecy at that time because of strictly enforced patriarchal norms. They were not allowed to read the Torah in public. They were not allowed to gather in public. But then we know that the church later on denigrated Mary Magdalene as the redeemed prostitute, and you mentioned Luke. We know there's this passage where it talks about, you know, well, the woman who had been possessed by seven demons, and she was demonized, and it was actually, you know, a Pope Gregory the Great, as he was called in the 6th century, who then created that myth. It's a myth, it's a fabrication, that Mary Magdalene was the woman who had been possessed by seven demons, as mentioned in Luke. And we know today that this was a fabrication. This is simply not true. And unfortunately, you know, people have believed that for centuries, and even today you still have people who look at Mary Magdalene with very mixed feelings. But on the other hand, she's making a reemergence as well. You know, there's the National Magdalene Movement that was founded last year, and people honor her and celebrate her as being invaluable for Jesus Christ to truly complete his ministry. So I just wanted to throw that in, and it's true that women in early Christianity were allowed to spread the gospel. They took on, you know, positions of leadership within the early church. Women were very active. In fact, most of Jesus' followers were women in the early times, so they supported him. And then later on, women were increasingly displaced from any positions of power that started in the 2nd century until, as we know, the church then became increasingly managed by men in the, you know, late 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries and beyond.
Right, yeah. And the interesting thing, though, even given that truth, you know, that the fact that men did take over, is that the old tradition was so strong, you know, they had to give some power and validity to Mary, right? And so she became right. The cult of Mary and a very important aspect, because they couldn't completely get rid of the feminine, it seems, because there was too much desire for the female side in terms of our spirituality. So they incorporated it into this idea of this perfect mother, but it's still there. And the fact, you know, that Easter is an important date in the calendar now, you know, there's the resurrection, mm-hmm. is, you know, overlaid on, you know, the goddess Astra's observance, right? So it's, again, they couldn't beat them, so they joined them. And this often happens, is that they overlay a new tradition on the ancient ones, but the old tradition seems to seep through, you know, that it can't be completely excised, right? There's it's too yes. powerful, and that's good news in a way, you know.
Yes, and I'm really glad you're bringing this up. That's another great entry point. We see that also with Mother Mary. She's a perfect example of what you were just talking about. In fact, you know, Mother Mary has a lot of symbols that connect her to the pre-Christ, you know, pagan goddesses, the great mothers of ancient civilizations, in particularly goddess Isis, because, you know, Mother Mary also has been attributed with great healing powers throughout the centuries. People have, you know, prayed at her shrines for healings. Great miracles have proliferated. I mean, in Europe, there is a whole network of, you know, as you know, pilgrimage sites, and in the country where I grew up in Switzerland, there's the beautiful Black Madonna in the little town of Einsiedeln, not too far from Zurich, and I visit her every time when I go back. And Mother Mary does have sometimes a crown of golden stars that adorn her, and these golden stars also relate her to other goddesses like the Sumerian great goddess Inanna Ishtar, who was called Lady of the Zodiac. That's just one of her many, many functions. And so we clearly see this symbolism, or Mother Mary standing on a lion, as in some of the Renaissance painting. That's a reference to the goddess as, you know, the mistress of the animals, the wild animals, and actually connects her to Mother Nature. And all of that is so visible, and there has been a lot of research around that, that Mother Mary is in some ways like a continuation, you know, the reemergence of the ancient great mother who was highly, highly worshipped and praised as the creative matrix of all beginning, as the one who brings the art of civilizations to her people, as the queen of heaven, another title that Mother Mary adopted in the 1950s. And there's countless examples that I could mention. But when you look at the statues of Mother Mary within the framework of, you know, the Roman Catholic Church and even, you know, Eastern Orthodoxy, you see that, of course, Mother Mary is not included in the Trinity. She's not part of it. So the Trinity is God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, who can be gender neutral depending on the language and translation. So Mother Mary is not considered on par with the Trinity, and so the great powers that these ancient mother goddesses had in pre-Christian times has been greatly curtailed and limited in Mother Mary, although she is still increasingly venerated as this great, you know, representation of the sacred feminine in Christianity by many people. And one more example about Mother Mary that I think our listeners will find quite intriguing, and many people don't know that, there are representations of Mother Mary during the medieval period, going back to the 13th century, that actually shows her as the mother who not only contains the entire universe within her being and essence, but also the Trinity. And these representations are called La Vierge Ouvrante. They have been found in France, in churches, and Ouvrant means the virgin, and you can open her mantle. And when you open her mantle, she reveals the Trinity within her and the entire universe. So she truly is the ancient mother goddess of the universe, the great matrix of creation at the beginning, who brought everything into being through her life force. And that's what in Hinduism, you know, the divine mother is Shakti, the creative life force that brings everything into being. So that's just another aspect of Mother Mary that, of course, gets mostly ignored. I mean, I never heard about that when I grew up and went to Sunday service, that's for sure.
right, absolutely. But like you said earlier, it's known to mystics, but not necessarily to the, you know, the general populace. It's a sort of a bit esoteric mystery that's kind of kept under wraps, you know, because it's considered to be too controversial, perhaps. But now, you know, like many things, we're beginning to look at these things and bring them out into the open. You know, think about the Tibetan diaspora. You know, there's so many Tibetans leaving Tibet because of the Chinese, and yet it's brought these wonderful teachings, deep teachings of Tibetan Buddhism to the West. And I think the same thing's happening in some of the traditions in the West itself. You know, that the things that were hidden are now being openly spoken about, and it's time for another shift, because it seems to me, in reading your book, you know, that up until about 5,000 years ago or so, 5 to 7, the most religious observance was around the goddess idea, right? Mm-hmm. Then there was a shift as we became, quote, civilized. We began to living cities and start to plant crops, etc. There was a shift to a more male aspect when we look at divinity. And yet, even at the time of Jesus, you know, in the Roman Empire, there were great shrines to the goddesses, right? In Asia Minor, mm-hmm. for instance, there you know, a lot of the cities there, Ephesus, etc., you know, worshipped the female form of God. So this was still powerful even during that later period.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I mean, the goddess Isis, for example, was greatly venerated, you know, also in the Roman Empire. You know, there were many temples dedicated to her until Christianity then became the official state religion and was strictly enforced, you know, by the emperor and the emerging church to, of course, preserve the doctrine. But it's true that, you know, of course, you know, the Romans had, you know, were polytheistic. They embraced many different gods and goddesses. So one god or goddess more or less really didn't matter in pagan understanding. But to come back to what you said earlier about, you know, the ancient religions being very focused on the mother, you know, the great mother, that is very true and has also been corroborated through a lot of research and, you know, especially archaeological findings by some great women pioneers, scholars, feminists, you know, archaeologists like Maria Gimbutas and others. And actually the worship of the mother goes literally back about 20,000 goes back to 25,000 before the Common Era, during what we call the prehistoric period or the Old Stone period, the Paleolithic. And a lot of these goddess figurines have been found at entrance of caves. You know, people were, of course, you know, going into these caves and seeking shelter from, you know, extreme weather patterns. And so they looked at the feminine as, you know, being able to bring forth new life. I mean, the birth-giving process was looked upon as being, you know, an expression of the miraculous. And so it's not that surprising that, you know, there was, they conceived of this great mother bringing forth all of life. And then when we move into, you know, the time of the Neolithic transition, when humans became farmers and domesticated animals, in all these great civilizations that emerged over the course of thousands of years, farming civilizations or river valley civilizations, we see, you know, great goddesses being honored on inscriptions after 3000 BC in ancient Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Iraq, of course, in India, in Egypt, she was called the sustainer of life, queen of heaven, you know, the one who brings forth harmony and, you know, has helped us to establish civilization, like pottery and weaving, all these arts. And in fact, believe it or not, the great goddess Isis in Egypt was referred to as the savior of the human race. We have these inscriptions, the savior of the human race. I mean, this is pretty interesting, you know, in the light of, you know, how religion has evolved over the centuries since then. So I just wanted to mention this particular example. So the mother is the first and the last, and we can say that birth, growth, decay, and death are all stages within the sacred life cycle that's affiliated with the feminine phase of the divine.
Absolutely fascinating stuff, isn't it? Yeah, and there's lots of these what they call Venuses, right? Like Venus of Willendorf or whatever, that have been found in Europe and other places that look interesting, because they usually have huge buttocks and mm-hmm. breasts, and they look like out of proportion, really. But maybe they represent the ultimate mm-hmm. infertility, right? This huge ability to bear forth children. And it represents exactly what you're talking about, you know, the creator of the universe, the creator of everything good, but also the destroyer. You know, there's a sense of the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And in India, of course, this is a big theme, isn't it, of Mother Kali and the goddess in her violent, wrathful form, if you like. But there's eating corpses and whatnot. Not to be feared, but it's talking about the way things work. You know, everything that's born is going to die. So it's all part of this cycle, this whole holistic understanding. And we don't get the same thing with a male god, I don't think. It's not quite as potent. You know, there's something very potent about Mother Nature, about the way the womb works, right?
Yes. Exactly. You touched on so many really important aspects. Well, one is that, you know, of course, the goddess has innumerable names and manifestations across the world cultures, and some of these conceptions are mysterious and even paradoxical because she represents both life and death. And we in the West tend to create this duality. We feel like, well, there is life and then death is something different. And we even have created this whole taboo about openly speaking about our mortality and our past. And go to a party, start to talk about our mortality, and then see how popular you're still going to be. So this is the thing, the goddess embraces this paradox. And when you really look deeper at life and death, you will see that the two are connected in this great cycle. When you go to the rainforest, for example, well, you see the foliage falling to the ground, and then it decomposes, but it creates nutrients for new plant growth to emerge. So we see beautiful this cycle of life and death, that the two are actually closely intertwined. And I remember my Zen master once even saying, with every breath we take, we get one breath closer to death. So the two are two sides of the one coin, and that's what the mother represents. That's why she has the benevolent manifestations and the fierce, terrifying manifestations. You mentioned, you know, the goddess is in the East, Kali, you know, the dark mother in Hinduism is a perfect example. She's the terrifying mother with the garland of severed heads. She dances, you know, on top of the
she comes.
Shiva,
Mother Kali has kept us off. But we'll be back in a couple of minutes after these messages from Unity. Join us then.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
When listeners like you contribute to Unity Online Radio, you're making a positive difference in your life and the lives of other spiritual seekers. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate to make a one-time donation, or sign up for monthly contributions. Thank you for your support.
Here's Eric Butterworth with a Unity Mindful Moment.
Jesus taught the infinite potential of man and the influence of the allness of God. And he said, "What I have done, you can do." This is the missing link in Christian religion. All that I have done, you can do too. Any great demonstration of law is repeatable. We tend to spend too much time looking to the people who demonstrate the law rather than the act of demonstration itself. Whenever anything is done, it can be done. The principle is, what God has done, God can do. And God can do for you because you are involved in the same infinite law. Practical metaphysics then deals with a repeatable Christ. But if Jesus demonstrated the law is demonstrable, therefore it can be done, and it can be done at any time by one who is in that consciousness.
To pick up the Eric Butterworth book, Practical Metaphysics, go to unity.org and click on Shop.
Since 1924, Daily Word has offered inspiration and practical teachings through daily prayer messages to help people of all faiths live happy, healthy lives. The magazine includes 2 months of daily affirmations, messages, articles, and spiritual poetry to help you get inspired. Subscriptions are available for print editions in large type and Spanish, as well as the digital subscription package that includes the online magazine with audio, smartphone app, and daily email. Get your subscription today. Visit dailyword.com or unity.org.
Discover Unity Village, and you'll find a peaceful oasis just 15 miles from downtown Kansas City, Missouri. If you're doing business in the area or looking for the perfect place for your retreat or conference, check out all that Unity Village has to offer. With 1,200 wooded acres, a beautiful nature trail, award-winning rose garden, golf course, and newly redesigned hotel and conference center, Unity Village has everything you need for that perfect event. Go to unityvillage.org to find out more.
Stretch your mind and open your heart every Thursday at 10 a.m. Central with Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien and the Yoga Hour, Living the Eternal Way. Gain insights into spiritual principles that touch upon the most practical aspects of our lives, like work, relationships, health, and diet. Discover time-tested practices from the ancient system of Kriya Yoga, a philosophy for living a more fulfilled life in today's hectic world. Only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Isabella Price. We're talking about her book, Goddess Power, Awakening the Wisdom of the Divine Feminine in Your Life. And I've been a student of Hinduism for many years, and one of the things that fascinates me is the fact that the goddess shows up in various forms, and notably the sort of benign, peaceful form, and then the more aggressive, wrathful form. And we tend to shy away from that sometimes, thinking, oh my goodness, that's a little too overwhelming. You know, if we see images of Kali eating the whole universe and spitting out bodies and got bracelets full of skulls and necklaces of skulls, and it's got a bright red tongue because of all the blood and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we have to understand it as the processes of nature, I think, the processes of the universe. And yet there's also that benign form which shows up in goddesses like Parvati, and then she has a terrible form in Durga. And I've got an image in my that I got for my 60th birthday of Annapurna, and Annapurna is the goddess of food, and it's the goddess in her benign form providing food for the whole universe. And mm-hmm. so that's a beautiful image. But I've also got an image of Kali in my study, because I like that image too, because it's it gets my attention. Yeah, Durga, of course, is the invincible, right? The inaccessible, mm-hmm. the invincible, the one that right. can overcome all negativity. And so we need those forces sometimes. And rather than see them as, like we said earlier, demonized, they are enfolded in one. Really, the Parvati and Durga, the peaceful side and the wrathful side, are the same goddess, right? It's not that they're two different goddesses. They're just two aspects of the amazing forces that are in the universe. Yes. If we were just a little closer to the sun, we'd burn up, but we're at the perfect distance. So the universe yes. is full of amazing forces that would destroy us if we weren't in our rightful place. Yes. And that's yes. true on our spiritual path too. But I know you want to right. talk about Kali, because it is an image for yes. our times in a way, yes?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so thank you again. It's just wonderful. You're touching on so many fascinating aspects. Well, exactly. First off, as you said, we need to understand that these expressions of the Divine Mother, as she's called in Hinduism, in the Shakta tradition, really encompasses all the paradox, is or what we perceive as a paradox. So, as you said, there are all aspects of the one divine source, you know, as, in this case, God as mother, and also beyond form, of course. There is much more to them than just the form. But, you know, again, the mother is benevolent and nurturing, but represents the fierce, terrifying mother because she is the mother of the mysteries of death. And I talked about the cycle of life and death being so intertwined. They are not a polarity, as we tend to think in our dualistic Western culture, where everything is rationalized away, and that applies to the mysteries of death in particular. So to come back to Mother Kali, the dark-skinned mother, yes, she has a fierce, terrifying manifestation. She dances on the cremation ground between funeral pyres. She dances on the corpse of Lord Shiva. And, you know, it's Shakti Shiva together, it's the dance, and they form together the harmonious universe. That's how Hindus look at them. But what does that mean? Why is she so fierce and terrifying? Let me just give you a very quick idea. The garland of severed heads that Mother Kali is wearing around her neck represents all our earthly attachments, all our ego-based fears and cravings that we need to overcome in order to evolve psychologically and spiritually. And what Kali does, she really invites us, sometimes forces us, to face our worst fears. And that is what Carl Gustav Jung called the shadow, you know, the unconscious or subconscious shadow in us that we all carry, the wounds that we have, whatever we have not fully processed and released, has to come to the surface so that we have the mirror that's being held in front of us, that we still need to do healing around these issues. And we cannot deny these issues. We cannot ignore them. We know it's psychologically not working. We have to process those so that we can eventually, hopefully, release those and heal ourselves. And what you see right now in the world being played out at large is this energy, this, you know, I call it the energies of the fierce mother, you know, especially dark-skinned mothers. And you see it collectively in, you know, the tensions, the conflicts, you know, there's still so much suffering, and we have to deal with the shadow, not just individually, each one of us, but collectively as a nation. When you look at the United States right now, all the collective shadow issues that have been repressed for so long are coming to the surface. Racism, sexism, Islamophobia, homophobia, the whole situation was, people who are, you know, have migrated to the United States, and, you know, the border was Mexico and the wall. All of that is an expression of these issues that have to come up. And even what we've done to the Native Americans, this has to be dealt with right now, because we cannot evolve and take the next leap, you know, in our consciousness. And this is where the dark mother comes in. She puts us through the crucible of facing what needs to be faced. And it's not easy, but these are the birth pangs preceding transformation, and we know the birth pangs are always painful. And this is how the dark mother works. She's a catalyst, an evolutionary catalyst, if you will, who really, really pushes us into facing that which we rather not want to face, because it's very uncomfortable and it hurts. And it's what the mystics have called the dark night journey of the soul. But let's not forget that it is precisely in darkness that wisdom and illumination can be gained. And this is what the dark-skinned mothers are all about.
Right. That's very, very interesting, isn't it? That, you know, like you say, Kali is dark skinned, but we're venerating the Black Madonnas as well, which, you know, have that same representation of this darkness. And even the phrase "Make America Great Again," you know, can have a double meaning, right? It may have one meaning to one political party or to one leader, but it may mean something else to another. You know, in the sense that we are making America greater than it was, because we are doing this work of integration. They may not see it like that if you're coming from a on the other side of things, which is, you know, putting America back to an era that it used to be. We can never do that. You never go back in time, I don't think. You can only move forward. But, you know, it's interesting to see what's going to unfold, because every day, it seems, is a new interesting. What did they say? You know, the curse in Chinese, curse is to may you live an interesting time.
We definitely
live in interesting times right now, that's right. For sure. But we have to keep a smile, I think, around this, right? There's no point getting depressed about it. You know, we have to give it the light touch.
Talking
about Shiva Shakti, you know, the Shiva represents the sort of the primordial essence of the universe, mm-hmm. which doesn't really have to do anything. It's the Shakti that does the work, right? It's the energy itself. And they need each other. Shiva Shakti are one within us. It's a lovely idea that we can't have the one without the other, you know, and they nest in each other. And so there's a beautiful poem from the... I think it's Mesopotamian tradition, right? Where that you quote in the book, that sounds a lot like the Song of Songs, and you can see that it's probably influenced the Song of Solomon, because it has very similar imagery in it. But it's the idea of the connectedness of the male and the female, and this is something important, I think, because some people who talk about the goddess sort of want to throw out the male, you know. It's the male god is gone. All we want is the goddess, and this isn't quite the way it is, right? It's about integration here. There's nothing wrong with the male god, but the male god has to be incorporated into the into the female. So we got this yin yang, Shiva Shakti idea, you know, that this holism, right?
Yes, absolutely, and I'm very excited to dive into that, because I'd like to elaborate more on that. I totally see it as an integration, and I call it like the sacred marriage within and without. But before I dive into that, you mentioned the Black Madonna. I just like to wrap that up with another example that, you know, the Black Madonna, and again, a lot of people don't know that, is not only a potent healer, because she represents Mother Nature, the raw, untamed forces, and that's why she's often been venerated in grottos, you know, close to water or in caves, that she is also a change agent. And when you look at some of the social justice movement, for example, you know, in Poland, actually in the 1980s, the workers used to carry an icon of the Black Madonna when they were demonstrating against oppressive Soviet rule. So they invoked her powers to help them, and it worked. You know, I mean, the system collapsed. So in Mexico, to mention an example from the Americas, the Mexican farm workers have also often invoked the Great Guadalupe, you know, their patroness, for, you know, support in their struggle, you know, against, you know, the elite. And so we can say that the Black Madonna, similar like Kali, is like the ultimate sacred activist who drives change and sustains repair and healing in the world. So she's really the mother of all people, no matter what gender, social status, race, sexual orientation, or religious affiliation. So I just wanted to wrap that up, and now I'm so happy to dive quickly into the sacred marriage, you know, that you said we need the integration of both, you know, the feminine and the masculine side of God, because together they form a whole, together they form the harmonious universe. And I usually talk about the archetypal masculine and the archetypal feminine in my book, and it's very important, first off, to understand that when I say that those terms are not identical with gender, because men also have the archetypal feminine within them as a quality, an energy, a potential. You know, Carl Gustav Jung, the Swiss psychologist, talked about the animus and anima, which is the archetypal masculine and feminine in both women and men, psychologically and energetically speaking. And unless we tap into both these archetypes within us, we cannot become whole human beings. So that's something I think we really need to be clear on. And so when we look at the traditions and the cultures, as you mentioned, you know, ancient Mesopotamia, they had this ritual of the sacred marriage between the king and the great priestess of the goddess Inanna Ishtar, and it was celebrated, you know, the whole community came together. The purpose was to ensure an abundant harvest for another year, and the goddess even endorsed the king in his political rule for another year. So he got the power from the mother. It was not the other way around. And so when we want to talk about what's going on today and how this is really important, I would say we have to do our inner work of transformation, which means we really have to tune into both the archetypal feminine and the archetypal masculine within us, again, to be able to be whole human beings and to be also able to take that next evolutionary leap, that next level of consciousness. And so that's why the two really have to come together in cooperative partnership. And that also applies to, you know, conscious women who have to really work in partnership with conscious men who are willing to support us. And so this is really absolutely essential, and I believe that as women we can do that. In fact, more and more women are stepping up and doing, you know, also great contributions in the world to make this world a better place, more sustainable, more worth living. And, you know, I mentioned in my book that term that, you know, visionary Barbara Max Hubbard coined. She talks about the feminine co-creator. So we women are stepping up and co-creating with conscious men who are supporting us. And so we become evolutionary agents in this sense if we fully step up and live in alignment with our dharmic purpose and are really ready to give our greatest contribution to, you know, the spiral of evolution. So this is just, you know, a few ideas. And again, in all cultures, that union between the masculine and feminine has been celebrated in so many forms. The biblical traditions was the, you know, Solomon and the beautiful Song of Songs. You know, this is all sacred marriage literature, and you mentioned that. So we need to reclaim the sacred in both the masculine and the feminine and bring them together in this beautiful cooperative partnership as equal partners in the dance of co-creating our future. That's how I see it.
Absolutely. And it's amazing in a way that, excuse me, got a cough here. Amazing in a way that their Song of Songs made it into the Bible, you know, because it's kind of sexual, certainly erotic, isn't it? And and it has many of those ideas. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I've got a little cough here. Here we go.
Fine.
The one you quote in the book from the Mesopotamian tradition or Sumerian tradition, of course, is even more overt, isn't it? And highly eroticized, but it has some of the same images that you get in the Song of Songs, you know, the talking about the apple tree, which bears fruit up to its crown. My honey, man, sweetens me always. He is the one my womb loves best. And it's just a wonderful celebration. And it's life at its best, isn't it? When we can celebrate all aspects of a thing.
Yes.
Before we finish today, gosh, I'm sorry about this. I'm going to catch in my throat too. Before we finish today, I'd really want to hit on the Minoan culture of Crete, because it's a lovely chapter in your book, and it seems that the ancient Minoan civilization was exceedingly well developed. You know, we see some of their arts and artifacts now. Thanks to discoveries in the 20th century, highly refined. And in the book, you say that they had also a highly refined civilization, you know, that honored the feminine, but was a very peaceful civilization.
Yes.
And there's one image that always struck me for many years, ever since I was a kid. That is the the image of the snake goddess, you know, holding the two snakes. And you described this this image beautifully, but she definitely represents this this ability. It's just amazing. Sketch it for us, would you? I'm sure you were very familiar with this image.
Yes. Well, it's interesting that you're bringing her up because, you know, she really is a continuation of the ancient snake goddess during the prehistoric time, during the Neolithic, where the mother was sometimes represented as half woman, half snake, or half animal, or half bird. And there is this different, you know, hybrids. And so this Minoan goddess, beautiful goddess holding up two snakes is to be seen in the tradition because, you know, the snake, the bird are two of the primary symbols of the mother of the universe and have been for thousands of years. And you might be wondering, well, why the snake? Well, you know, as you know, the snake sheds its skin periodically. So it's not surprising that the snake came to be viewed as a symbol of regeneration and even eventually mortality. And so, of course, the whole regenerative aspect relates the snake to the mother, and the snake lives partly in the water and in the earth. So these are the elements of, you know, the divine mother. And so the Minoan goddess, sometimes she's referred to as a goddess priestess, you know, and there is even some speculation that perhaps they had a priestess queen ruling the island, but because the script of Minoan Crete has regrettably not yet been deciphered, we cannot know for sure. So this is open to speculation, but definitely we see many of these, you know, statues of the feminine, you know, the goddess in Minoan culture, most prominently the one you mentioned, holding up two snakes, and then she also has a tamed leopard on her head, which represents the forces of nature that she embodies and can tame. She's surrounded by mountains, by lions on top of a mountain because they actually worshipped her in nature. They had altars out in nature. They worshipped, they did rituals on mountain peaks. The mountain has always been considered a pillar, a sacred pillar connecting heaven and earth. So, of course, the mother was worshipped in nature, in caves. Caves are the womb of the earth. It makes sense to worship her there. So it's a very fascinating culture, and it was really the last culture where we can say the goddess worship flowered. It was the peak of goddess worship, and then the Minoan culture, you know, declined in the first millennium BC. But what's also interesting, and you mentioned that, is that they were very peace-oriented. And this is one of the values of goddess religion, you know, resolving conflicts peacefully, living in harmony with nature, living as responsible stewardship, cooperation, partnership, creativity, and playfulness. These are all values of the goddess wisdom traditions. And so what we see today in the world being played out at large is what I call the unhealthy masculine, or, you know, the hyper-masculine, which is based on domination, hierarchical structures, exploitation of natural resources, continuous warfare, and the list goes on and on. Just to give you an idea what values and paradigms I'm talking about with specific examples.
And it's interesting, again, that the goddess Durga in India, you know, also rides on a lion. So when we know there's many connections in the Indo-European tradition between the Greek mythology and Hindu mythology, etc., The snake has got a bad rap in the Bible, you know, starting with the fall of man, I guess, the serpent. And yet it also has another, the way that the ancient Hebrews looked at the snake. They saw the snake in the same way that we're talking about, as a regeneration and creativity, because Moses talked about lifting up the snake in the wilderness. And Jesus himself advised us to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. So using a sort of a conundrum there, right? The paradox. How do you do that? How do you be as wise as a serpent and innocent as a dove? But this, again, is the sacred marriage, you know, between seemingly disparate things that come together in as one. So you've got the wisdom of the snake, the mm-hmm. feminine, and then the dove of innocence. So it's like marrying the two together. So fascinating, yes. fascinating stuff. So much we can learn from archetypes and myths and symbology, right? That that is rich for us in our spiritual and unfoldment as human beings. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Would you like to give us some wisdom that you think is important right now for our listeners? What would they benefit from hearing in the next minute?
Well, you know, of course, perhaps one thing would be how to tap more into that feminine face of the divine, you know, through perhaps some practices. I mean, if you feel so called to do that, you know, you can always, you know, by honoring the earth, Mother Nature, this is a beautiful way of connecting with the wisdom of the sacred feminine, connecting with the earth and all her beings, protecting them from exploitation. You can also invoke the mother, you can visualize her, but she's form and beyond form, but visualizations help you to connect with her in devotional practices, what is called, you know, bhakti yoga in Hinduism, opens the heart so you can receive her. And the mother really can only be felt and received based on a genuine and heartfelt intention. So the alchemical process, the transformation happens in the heart. And of course, you can do rituals honoring her in all her forms and names across the culture and even beyond form as just an energy, Shakti, the energy of life, the vital life force that works in us, as us, and through us, in our intuition, in our creativity, in many, many forms. So if you feel called to tune in with her, these are some suggestions, and just, you know, meet her in the stillness of nature, wherever you feel called to go, and invoke her, celebrate her, and especially go, you know, for walks in nature, commune with nature, see the messages that come to you through the tree, through a bird, a flower. This is how we can connect with our energies and tune in more deeply.
Beautiful. And folks, if you want to get the book, it's available in all the usual outlets. It's called Goddess Power by Isabella Price. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Isabella. Next mm-hmm. week, Elizabeth Fournier joins me, and she's going to talk about green burials. I've never done a book, I've never done a subject on that before, but the book she's written, it's called Green Burial Guidebook, is very fascinating, and she provides excellent understanding of how we can have a more organic death experience here instead of buying into you know, not saying they're wrong, but some of the industry that requires us to spend more and more money. There's ways to do it in a different sense. So join me next week for that. Right now, thank you so much, Isabella. What a wonderful show.
Well, thank you, Reverend Paul. It was a true delight to engage in conversation with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.